Chapter 22. A very singular prohibition, remarked Mrs. Fine after a short silence. He seemed to love the child. She was puzzled, but I surmised that it might have been the sullenness of a man unconscious of guilt and standing at bay to fight his executors, as he called them, or else the fear of a softer emotion weakening his defiant attitude. Perhaps, even, it was a self-denying ordinance, in order to spare the girl the sight of her father in the dock, accused of cheating, sentenced as a swindler proving the possession of a certain moral delicacy. Mrs. Fine didn't know what to think. She supposed it might have been mere callousness. But the people amongst whom the girl had fallen had positively not a grain of moral delicacy. Of that she was certain. Mrs. Fine could not undertake to give me an idea of their abominable vulgarity. Flora used to tell her something of her life in that household, over there, down Limehouse Way. It was incredible. It passed Mrs. Fine's comprehension. It was a sort of moral savagery which she could not have thought possible. I, on the contrary, thought it very possible. I could imagine easily how the poor girl must have been bewildered, and heard at her reception in that household envied for her past, while delivered defenseless to the tender mercies of people without any fineness either of feeling or mind, unable to understand her misery, grossly curious, mistaking her manner for disdain, her silent shrinking for pride. The wife of the dious person was witless and fatuously conceited. Of the two girls of the house, one was pious, and the other a romp. Both were coarse-minded, if they may be credited with any mind at all. The rather numerous men of the family were dense and grumpy, or dense and jocous. None in that grubbing lot had enough humanity to leave her alone. At first she was made much of, in an offensively patronizing manner. The connection with the great DeBarrel gratified their vanity even in the moment of the smash. They dragged her to their place of worship, whatever it might have been, where the congregation stared at her, and they gave parties to other beings like themselves at which they exhibited her with ignoble self-satisfaction. She did not know how to defend herself from their importunities, insolence and exigencies. She lived amongst them, a passive victim, quivering in every nerve, as if she were flayed. After the trial her position became still worse. On the least occasion, and even on no occasions at all, she was scolded, or else taunted with her dependence. The pious girl lectured her on her defects, the romping girl teased her with contemptuous references to her accomplishments, and was always trying to pick insensate quarrels with her about some fellow or other. The mother backed up her girls invariably, adding her own silly, wounding remarks. I must say they were probably not aware of the ugliness of their conduct. They were nasty amongst themselves as a matter of course. Their disputes were nauseating in origin, in manner, in the spirit of mean selfishness. These women too, seemed to enjoy greatly any sort of row, and were always ready to combine together, to make awful scenes to the luckless girl on incredibly flimsy pretenses. Thus Flora on one occasion, had been reduced to rage and despair, had her most secret feelings lacerated, had obtained a view of the utmost baseness to which common human nature can descend. I won't say he proposed a botch as the French would excellently put it, but literally he proposed of some mislaid cheap lace trimmings for a nightgown the romping one was making for herself. Yes, that was the origin of one of the grossest scenes which, in their repetition, must have had a deplorable effect on the unformed character of the most pitiful of DeBarrel's victims. I have it from Mrs. Fine. The girl turned up at the Fine's house at 9:30 on a cold, drizzly evening. As he had walked bareheaded, I believe, just as she ran out of the house, from somewhere in Poplar to the neighborhood of Sloane Square without stopping, without drawing breath, if only for a sob. We were having some people to dinner, said the anxious sister of Captain Anthony. As he had heard the front door bell, and wondered what it might mean. The parlor maid managed to whisper to her without attracting attention. The servants had been frightened by the invasion of that wild girl in a muddy skirt, and with wisps of damp hair sticking to her pale cheeks. But they had seen her before. This was not the first occasion, nor yet the last. Directly she could slip away from her guests, Mrs. Fine ran upstairs. I found her in the night nursery crouching on the floor, her head resting on the cot of the youngest of my girls. The eldest was sitting up in bed looking at her across the room. Only a nightlight was burning there. Mrs. Fine raised her up, took her over to Mr. Fine's little dressing room on the other side of the landing, to a fire by which she could dry herself, and left her there. She had to go back to her guests. A most disagreeable surprise it must have been to the Fines. Afterwards they both went up and interviewed the girl. She jumped up at their entrance. She had shaken her damp hair loose. Her eyes were dry with the heat of rage. I can imagine little Fine solemnly sympathetic, solemnly listening, solemnly retreating to the marital bedroom. Mrs. Fine pacified the girl, and, fortunately, there was a bed which could be made up for her in the dressing room. But what could one do after all, concluded Mrs. Fine. And this stereotyped exclamation, expressing the difficulty of the problem, and the readiness, at any rate, of good intentions, made me, as usual, feel more kindly towards her. Next morning, very early, long before Fine had to start for his office, the dais personage turned up, not exactly unexpected perhaps, but startling all the same, if only by the promptness of his action. From what Flora herself related to Mrs. Fine, it seems that without being very perceptibly less dais than his family, he had in a rather mysterious fashion interposed his authority for the protection of the girl. Odd that he cares, explained Flora. I'm sure he does not. I could not stand being liked by any of these people. If I thought he liked me, I would drown myself, rather than go back with him. For of course he had come to take Lori home. The scene was the dining room breakfast interrupted, dishes growing cold, little Fine's toast growing leathery, Fine out of his chair with his back to the fire, the newspaper on the carpet, servants shut out, Mrs. Fine rigid in her place with the girl sitting beside her, the odious person, who had bustled in with hardly a greeting, looking from Fine to Mrs. Fine, as though he were inwardly amused at something he knew of them, and then beginning ironically his discourse. He did not apologize for disturbing Fine and his good lady at breakfast, because he knew they did not want, with a nod at the girl, to have more of her than could be helped. He came the first possible moment, because he had his business to attend to. He wasn't drawing a tip-top salary this staring at Fine in a luxuriously furnished office. Not he. He had risen to be an employer of labor, and was bound to give a good example. I believe the fellow was aware of, and enjoyed quietly, the consternation his presence brought to the bosom of Mr. and Mrs. Fine. He turned briskly to the girl. Mrs. Fine confessed to me that they had remained all three silent and inanimate. He turned to the girl. Hats this game, Flory. You had better give it up. If you expect me to run all over London looking for you every time you happen to have a tiff with your auntie and cousins, you are mistaken. I can't afford it. Tiff was the sort of definition, to take one's breath away, having regard to the fact that both the word convict and the word pauper had been used a moment before Flora de Barrel ran away from the quarrel about the lace trimmings. Yes, these very words. So at least the girl had told Mrs. Fine the evening before. The word tiff in connection with her tale had a peculiar savor, a paralyzing effect. Nobody made a sound. The relative of the barrel proceeded uninterrupted to a display of magnanimity. Auntie told me to tell you she's sorry there. And Amelia, the romping sister, shan't worry you again. I'll see to that. You ought to be satisfied. Remember your position. Emboldened by the utter stillness pervading the room, he addressed himself to Mrs. Fine with stolid effrontery. What I say is that people should be good-natured. She can't stand being chaffed. She puts on her grand airs. She won't take a bit of a joke from people as good as herself anyway. We are a plain lot. We don't like it. And that's how trouble begins. Insensible to the stony stare of three pairs of eyes, which, if the stories of our childhood, as to the power of the human eye are true, ought to have been enough to daunt a tiger, that unabashed manufacturer from the East End fastened his fangs, figuratively speaking, into the poor girl and prepared to drag her away for a prey to his cubs of both sexes. Untie has thought of sending you your hat and coat. I've got them outside in the cab. Mrs. Fine looked mechanically out of the window. A four-wheeler stood before the gate under the weeping sky. The driver in his conical cape and tarpaulin hat, streamed with water. The drooping horse looked as though it had been fished out, half unconscious, from a pond. Mrs. Fine found some relief in looking at that miserable sight, away from the room in which the voice of the amiable visitor resounded with a vulgar intonation exhorting the strayed sheep to return to the delightful fold. Ohm, Flory, make a move. I can't wait on you all day here. Mrs. Fine heard all this without turning her head away from the window. Fine on the hearthrug, had to listen, and to look onto. I shall not try to form a surmise as to the real nature of the suspense. Their very goodness must have made it very anxious. The girl's hands were lying in her lap, her head was lowered, as if in deep thought, and the other went on delivering a sort of homily. Ingratitude was condemned in it, the sinfulness of pride was pointed out together with the proverbial fact that it owes before a fall. There were also some sound remarks, as to the danger of nonsensical notions, and the disadvantages of a quick temper. It sets one's best friends against one. And if anybody ever wanted friends in the world, it's you, my girl. Even respect for parental authority was invoked. And the first hour of his trouble your father wrote to me to take care of you, don't forget it. Yes, to me. Just a plain man, rather than to any of his fine West End friends. You can't get over that. And a father's a father no matter what a mess he's got himself into. You ain't going to throw over your own father, are you? It was difficult to say whether he was more absurd than cruel or more cruel than absurd. Mrs. Fine, with the fine ear of a woman, seemed to detect a jeering intention in his meanly unctuous tone, something more vile than mere cruelty. She glanced quickly over her shoulder, and saw the girl raise her two hands to her head, then let them fall again on her lap. Fine in front of the fire, was like the victim of an unholy spell bereft of motion and speech, but obviously in pain. It was a short pause of perfect silence, and then that odious creature, he must have been really a remarkable individual in his way, struck out into sarcasm. Well? Dot dot, again a silence. If you have fixed it up with the lady and gentleman present here for your board, and lodging, you had better say so. I don't want to interfere in a bargain I know nothing of. But I wonder how your father will take it when he comes out. Dot daughter, don't you expect him ever to come out? At that moment, Mrs. Fine told me she met the girl's eyes. There was that in them which made her shut her own. She also felt as though she would have liked to put her fingers in her ears. She restrained herself, however, and the lame man passed in his appalling versatility from sarcasm to veiled menace. You have eh? Well and good. But before I go home, let me ask you, my girl, to think if by any chance you throwing us over like this won't be rather bad for your father later on? Just think it over. He looked at his victim with an air of cunning mystery. She jumped up so suddenly that he started back. Mrs. Fine rose too, and even the spell was removed from her husband. But the girl dropped again into the chair and turned her head to look at Mrs. Fine. This time it was no accidental meeting of fugitive glances. It was a deliberate communication. To my question, as to its nature, Mrs. Fine said she did not know. As it appealing? I suggested. Oh, she said. As it frightened, angry, crushed, resigned? Oh, no. Nothing of these. But it had frightened her. She remembered it to this day. as he had been ever since fancying she could detect the lingering reflection of that look in all the girls' glances. In the attentive, in the casual, even in the grateful glances, in the expression of the softest moods. Has she her soft moods, then? I asked with interest. Mrs. Fine, much moved by her recollections, heeded not my inquiry. All her mental energy was concentrated on the nature of that memorable glance. The general tradition of mankind teaches us that glances occupy a considerable place in the self-expression of women. Mrs. Fine was trying honestly to give me some idea, as much perhaps to satisfy her own uneasiness as my curiosity. She was frowning in the effort, as you see sometimes a child do. What is delightful in women is that they so often resemble intelligent children. I mean the crustiest, the sourest, the most battered of them do at times. She was frowning, I say, and I was beginning to smile faintly at her, when all at once she came out with something totally unexpected. It was horribly merry, she said. I suppose she must have been satisfied by my sudden gravity, because she looked at me in a friendly manner. Yes, Mrs. Fine, I said, smiling no longer. See, it would have been horrible even on the stage. Ah, she interrupted me, and I really believe her change of attitude back to folded arms was meant to check a shudder. But it wasn't on the stage, and it was not with her lips that she laughed. Yes. It must have been horrible, I assented. And even as he had to go away ultimately, I suppose. You didn't say anything? No, said Mrs. Fine. Rang the bell and told one of the maids to go and bring the hat and coat out of the cab. And then we waited. I don't think that there ever was such waiting, unless possibly in a jail at some moment or other on the morning of an execution. The servant appeared with the hat and coat, and then, still as on the morning of an execution, when the condemned, I believe, is offered a breakfast, Mrs. Fine, anxious that the white-faced girl should swallow something warm if she could, before leaving her house for an interminable drive through raw cold air in a damp four-wheeler, Mrs. Fine broke the awful silence. Who really must try to eat something, in her best resolute manner. She turned to the dais person with the same determination. Perhaps you will sit down, and have a cup of coffee too. The worthy employer of labor sat down. He might have been awed by Mrs. Fine's peremptory manner, for she did not think of conciliating him then. He sat down, provisionally, like a man who finds himself much against his will in doubtful company. He accepted ungraciously the cup handed to him by Mrs. Fine. Took an unwilling sip or two, and put it down, as if there were some moral contamination in the coffee of these wells. Between whiles he directed mysteriously inexpressive glances at Little Fine, who, I gather, had no breakfast that morning at all. Neither had the girl. She never moved her hands from her lap till her appointed guardian got up, leaving his cup half full. Well, if you don't mean to take advantage of this lady's kind offer, I may just as well take you home at once. I want to begin my day, I do. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.